This is a section that is quite lengthy. It begins in chapter 8, verse 1. It goes all the way through verse 1 of chapter 11. It will seem as if Paul is taking some side roads and some detours along the way. And his writing will deal not just with the action of eating meat, but doing so in the pagan temples. He's going to talk about the apostles' renunciation of rites. He's going to talk about a warning from the history of Israel about being disqualified. And then, as chapter 10 winds down, he's going to return to the subject of idol feasts and idol meat and the freedom that believers have. He then will sum up the entire passage, beginning in verse 31 of chapter 10, going through the first verse of chapter 11. I hope you've read this. We've been parked here the last couple of Wednesday nights. So if you've been a part of our Wednesday night class, we've been here for 2 weeks and we've got one more week in it. So if you're inclined to study this in greater depth and you've not been a part of the Wednesday night class, let me encourage you to come and to join us. But chapter 8 states the problem. Paul says, now about food sacrificed to idols. And it's not really about just the food sacrificed to idols. It's whether or not you can eat that food that had been sacrificed to idols. It seems that some in the Corinthian church claimed to have a knowledge, a superior knowledge of one God. He says, we know that we all possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. So there is this knowledge of one God. There is this knowledge that idols are nothing. And so this knowledge prompts a behavior that Paul says is not always good. It would seem that Paul evidently had said at some point in the past, this is probably not something you should do. Some scholars and some commentators would point back to Acts chapter 15, and they would make the point that all Gentile Christians had to be taught that you abstained from meat, from food that had been offered to idols. I don't know if that was the case in Corinth or not. I don't know if that was a blanket statement for all Gentile converts or not. But it would make sense that at some point Paul had said, you probably shouldn't do this. And the Corinthians had said, well, we're smart enough. We know that it's really okay. I can do this. It's all right. Now, the temples, the pagan temples were the restaurants of the first century. Obviously, they didn't have McDonald's and Wendy's like we do. They had these big, elaborate temples, and these temples would have, as a part of their facility, a dining hall. And the food that was eaten in the dining hall at one time was offered in sacrifice to a pagan deity. And so it was fairly common to go to these dining halls to eat. It was fairly common to go to the market and to find food there for sale that had been offered in sacrifice to an idol. What tended to be going on, though, is that the Corinthians were defending their right to do this based on their superior knowledge. They knew that God was the only God. They knew that food was neutral. Therefore, what they were doing in their mind was harmless. And then going further than their rejection of Paul's teaching, it seemed like they were encouraging, perhaps even causing some new Christians to join them with destructive results. Rick Oster in his commentary says, the Corinthians were unconcerned about the consequences of their freedom. So the big picture here is that some in the Corinthian church were continuing to mingle parts of their past pagan life with their new life of following Jesus. And they were arrogant and prideful about doing so, based on their enlightened knowledge that there was only one God, that such things like food didn't really matter anyway. But they did not consider how the intermingling of their pagan past life and their new Christian life could cause severe damage to a new, weaker believer. And a major point that Paul is going to make is that we should think of others first by lovingly and humbly imitating Jesus. Now, we don't have time to read all this, so we're going to try to unpack it as best we can. And there are four... Are you with me? With me so far? Hadn't lost anybody yet? Okay, if look around, look to the person to your left, look to the person to your right. If they're dozing, kind of nudge them a little bit. There are four distinct movements in this text. Four arguments, if you will, that Paul is going to use or that he is going to make in order to make his main point. And the first thing that he says, and this is all of chapter 8, and that is that knowledge puffs up. Knowledge makes us arrogant. Knowledge makes us prideful. But love builds up. And so chapter 8 introduces the specific problem, eating meat, eating food that had been sacrificed to idols. Paul says that not all have this same level of knowledge when it comes to the one God. When it comes to the fact that there's one God, and when it comes to the fact that there are many pagan idols out there that are believed in, not everybody has the same level of knowledge. Even some new converts may still struggle with this idea that there are many pagan deities. And Paul says, those of you that have this superior knowledge, if you're not careful, that knowledge can destroy the faith of one who is weak. And Paul's main argument, his main statement of chapter 8, is the very last verse. If what I eat causes my brother or my sister to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause him to fall. So in the context of a weaker brother or a sister who still attaches some significance to eating this food that had been offered to an idol, Paul says, if it comes right down to it, I'm not going to touch it. Because I don't want what I do to cause my brother or my sister to fall. Now, it seems like where he goes in chapter 9 is a detour. It seems like Paul takes a lot of detours in his writings, but really he doesn't. We just have to step back and kind of look at the big picture here. You see, what the Corinthians were likely saying is that, hey, we know there's only one God. We know there's nothing special about this food. If I want to go eat this food, it is my right to do so. If I want to do this, I have the freedom to do so because I know there's only one God. I know that there's nothing special about food. All food is neutral. So I have the right, I have the freedom to do this. And to that, Paul would say, I have a lot of freedoms as an apostle. I have plenty of rights as an apostle. This is my defense. This is verse 3. To those who would sit in judgment on me, don't we have the right to food and drink? Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us as do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas? Or is it only I and Barnabas who must work for a living? I have certain rights as an apostle that I am willing to give up. I have certain freedoms as an apostle, Paul says, that I am willing to give up. Paul chose to renounce certain things that he could have laid claim to. He chose to renounce those things for the greater good. Yes, he was entitled to certain things. He had the freedom to do certain things. He had certain rights. But he chose not to exercise those rights for the greater good of reaching more people with the gospel. The second half of verse 12, on the contrary, we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Verse 15, but I have not used any of these rights. The main point of this chapter is what he says about becoming all things to all people, beginning in verse 22. To the weak, he says, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. There is an emphasis here on the weak. The weak is the one that he referred to back in chapter 8, verse 13. The weak is the person that he will not cause to fall into sin. The weak is the person that he will avoid meat for forever, if necessary. So he says, to the weak, I became like a weak person. I become all things to all people that I might by all means save some. Now we tend to use this verse as kind of a theology of missions. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. But we always need to remember context. What Paul is saying is that I became like this. I put myself in their shoes. This person who's weak, this person whose faith could very well be destroyed because I eat this meat that's been offered to an idol. Paul says, I put myself in their shoes so that I might win them to Jesus. I don't exercise my rights. I don't necessarily take what's rightfully mine. I give all of that up for the sake of the gospel. And then there's another passage that's somewhat familiar to us, beginning in verse 24 of chapter 9, where Paul talks about running the race and this disciplined life. And he says, I don't run like a man who runs aimlessly. I don't run like a man who beats the air. He says, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. The Christian life is a disciplined life. If Paul chose to live in a selfish, undisciplined way, he's writing that he could be disqualified for the prize. We don't live this life aimlessly. We're moving toward a prize. We're moving toward a goal. That goal is Christ-likeness. That goal is transformation into the image of Jesus. That's the goal. So we're not just running around like chickens with our head cut off, living the Christian life. We're pursuing a goal. If we pursue a goal, we have to live in somewhat of a disciplined way. Paul says, if I don't do that, I run the risk of being disqualified. And that seems to trigger what he's going to write about beginning in chapter 10. Remember, Paul didn't divide his writings into chapter and verses. This thought of being disqualified leads him to the point of the history of Israel. For I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered over the desert. Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Don't be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 of them died. We should not test the Lord as some of them did and were killed by snakes, and do not grumble as some of them did and were killed by the destroying angel. These things happened to them as examples, and were written down as warnings for us on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So, if you think that you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. Paul's point is that if I, Paul, could be disqualified, let me make this point from the history of my people. All of the Israelites had experienced God's presence. They experienced God's blessing, just as the Corinthians had experienced God's presence and God's blessing. But Paul makes the point that with most of them, Israel, God was not pleased. In other words, Paul says it is possible to fall out of favor with God. The end of chapter 9, Paul says, I have to live a disciplined life. I renounce my rights. I don't live as I want to live. I don't live in a selfish manner. I live in view of the prize. I live in view of the goal. And if I don't do that, I can be disqualified. Look at what happened to Israel. Israel crossed through the sea. I think that's what it means to be baptized into Moses. They crossed the Red Sea. They ate the same spiritual food. They drank the same spiritual drink. It's very difficult to read that and our practice of baptism and our practice of communion, eating bread and drinking spiritual drink. It's very hard to read that and those things not come into our mind. And I think that's intentional. Paul's point is, just because you have experienced God in some way doesn't mean it's over. It doesn't mean that you can go out and live however you want to live. Just because you've experienced the favor and the blessing and the presence of God does not mean you have arrived. N.T. Wright says, in other words, you must not presume that because you are baptized Christians, sharing in the community life where the Spirit is known and present, and eating and drinking the bread and wine of the Eucharist, you have automatically reached a level that requires no further moral effort or restraint. Richard Hayes says it a little more plainly. Just because you have received spiritual blessings, do not suppose that you are exempt from God's judgment. And so the major point of this section is, don't make the same mistake. If you think you're standing, if you're full of knowledge and you have arrogance and you have pride and you think you're standing, you better be careful. Be careful that you don't fall. Still with me? Left, right, nudge. Okay. Verses 14 through 22, Paul kind of goes back now to the original subject. Okay? He goes back to the original subject. He goes back to this idea of idol feasts. But he begins by talking about the Lord's Supper. He begins by talking about communion. And he basically says, when we observe communion, when we share the bread and the juice, when we do all of that together, there is a participation with Christ that occurs. That's why it's called communion. Fellowshipping together, sharing together. There's something going on in the spiritual dimension. We're not just taking a little piece of cracker. We're not just taking a little sip of juice. It's much bigger than that. It's deeper than that. There is a spiritual reality that is occurring when we share that communion together. Okay? Paul says, just like that, even though, he says, he's already said this, we know an idol's nothing. We know this food is nothing. An idol is nothing. If this chair were an idol, it's nothing. It's a chair. It's an idol. There's nothing spiritual about this chair. But, Paul says, the demons in the spiritual world are very real. Do you believe that we have a spiritual enemy? Okay. Well, this shouldn't be too hard for us to grasp then. God is real. God's angels are real. But you know what? Satan is real. And Satan has his messengers, his angels, if you will, and they're just as real. And Paul says, even though this idol is nothing, if I believe in this idol, I am in essence believing in the anti-God world. I'm believing in the anti-God entity that's out there, Satan and demons. And even though this idol is nothing, if I sacrifice and I worship, Paul says, there is a participation, there is a sharing together, just like in our communion, there's a sharing that occurs with the demons in the spiritual world. Paul says, you don't want to go there. You don't want to do that. Because it is real, he says. And he says, we don't want to arouse the Lord's jealousy. We are not stronger than he. Paul says, you cannot participate in both. You can't share, you can't fellowship at the table of the Lord, while at the same time sharing and participating in what someone else sees as the demon world. You can't do both. And to think that you can is a very dangerous place. Beginning in verse 23, this is the heart of what he's saying. Everything is permissible, which is likely something the Corinthians were saying. Everything is permissible, but Paul would say not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible, but Paul would say not everything is constructive. Underline verse 24, highlight verse 24, memorize verse 24. Nobody should seek his own good, but the good of others. Eat anything sold in the meat market without raising questions of conscience, for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. If some unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever's put before you without raising questions of conscience. But if anyone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, well, don't eat it then. Both for the sake of the man who told you and for conscience sake. The other man's conscience, I mean, not yours. If somebody says to you, hey, hey, that meat's been offered in sacrifice, you might not want to touch that, you know, that's, then don't eat it. Because obviously the person that's told you thinks that there's something to it. Don't offend that person. Verse 31, so whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, this is another one to highlight, underline, or memorize. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do we catch that? Sounds similar to Colossians 3:17, does it not? Everything that you do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God, even as I try to please everybody in every way, for I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. Whatever we do, everything we do, it is to be done for God's glory. It is to be done for God's honor. We don't seek our own good, but the good of others. We follow the example of Jesus. That's the best I can do at unpacking two chapters in about 25 minutes. Now, the question is, and this is wake-up time, so if you've been letting your neighbor nap, this is the time to wake them up. The question, so what? What in the world does this long text, this winding argument, you know, what relevance does this have for me today? First thing I want to say is, the weak, the new believer, the new convert in Corinth, the one who is struggling with the idea of one God versus many gods, the one whose faith could be destroyed if they saw a believer in the pagan temple eating the meat, Paul's not talking to them. Okay? So we got to get that first. Paul's not talking to them. So if you're here this morning, I'm not going to call you weak, but I'm going to say if you're here and you're a new convert, you're a new believer, your faith is somewhat shaky and you're not real sure about what this Christian life is all about, let me just say to you, don't let your faith be destroyed by people. If you're a new Christian, if you're a new believer, and sometimes those of us who have been Christians a long time need to be reminded of that, your faith is not in people, your faith is in a person, one person, Jesus. So, whatever stage we are in life, we need to remember that the actions of another individual are no excuse for my walking away from the faith. My faith must be in the one who died for me. Now, this is perhaps the most important thing I'm going to say. It is difficult, if not impossible, to replicate this specific issue of eating meat offered to idols today. It is difficult, if not impossible, to come up with a modern day situation that parallels this. That disappoints you, doesn't it? That disappoints you. Because we want to know what it is I can't do today that equates to this. Right? It's kind of the way we think. Every sermon that I've ever heard on this subject, probably every class I've ever been a part of, has spent the majority of the time trying to figure out what it is that parallels this today. What it is that I can't do today that equates to what Paul is writing about here. And here's the problem with that. When we do that, we lose the message. When we do that, we get lost in the details and we miss the overall point of Paul's argument. Trying to come up with a modern day parallel situation causes us to miss the forest for the trees. And perhaps, I'm going to suggest, perhaps it's best that we can't. Because you see, it'd be real easy. Oh, this is talking about alcohol. And this is talking about where I can go to eat or where I can go to drink or whatever. That's what this is talking about. So, oh, I got that issue. Okay, I'm okay with that. You see the danger? If we pinpoint this, then we're going to exclude an awful lot of what I think Paul is talking about. To quote Richard Hayes again, he says, even though this may appear to be an obscure problem from our point of view, we should take this section of the letter seriously and try to understand what was at stake. Idol meat was an issue because it dramatized some larger concerns. If you're a point person, you know, you want your 1, 2, 3, 4, or you might prefer one. We preachers like to do three. But if you're a point person, here are your points. Number one, there are blurred lines between the church and culture. And Paul says it's very dangerous to try to walk that line. There are blurred lines between church and culture. And Paul says it is very dangerous to try to walk that line. People who are serious about recovery, they understand the fact that they have to make a break from their old life if they're going to be successful in their new life. There's only one thing that has to change, and that's everything. The person who tries to walk the line between their old life and their new life is going to struggle. Paul says some blurred lines there, and it's dangerous. Another danger here is the danger of idolatry. While idols may be nothing, the spiritual world is very real. Demonic forces in the spiritual world are very real. But then there's also this sense of idols that are modern. You know, we have some idols. We don't want to admit it. But I would speculate that right now, some of you are consumed with the thought of when I'm going to quit because you've got a certain place you want to get to by a certain time so that you can feed this god. And you can beat the crowd there. Or maybe your favorite football team is getting ready to kick off in about 55 minutes, and that's your idol. Or maybe your favorite team played last night or yesterday. We talked about this in the Wednesday night class a few weeks ago. In our modern culture, there are many things that threaten our allegiance to the Lord. And when we put them at a higher place than God in our life, we are making them an idol. There is an idol in America of affluence, the pursuit of wealth, the danger of idolatry. Number three, the relationship between knowledge and love as the foundation for the church's life and fellowship. Paul would say some rites can actually be wrong. Some gray areas are prohibitive. Paul would say that loving servanthood should outweigh the exercise of freedom. And then point number four would be, I need to imitate Jesus. I need to imitate Jesus. I'm reminded of Philippians chapter 2. where Paul writes, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each one of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross." That's what it means to imitate Jesus. So there are your 4 points, but I still don't think that pegs it. I still don't think that gets to the heart of what Paul is trying to say. And here's what I believe that is. It's not about me. It's not about me. It's not about me. Quite simple, huh? Charles Swindoll says, "What does the Lord do to help broaden my horizons and assist me in seeing how selfish I am? Very simple. He gives me 4 busy kids who step on shoes, wrinkle clothes, spill milk, lick car windows, and drop sticky candy on the carpet. Being unselfish in attitude strikes at the very core of our being. It means we are willing to forego our own comfort, our own preferences, our own schedule, our own desires for another's benefit. And that brings us back to Christ. Please hear me. Hear this. If I insist on doing the things that I want to do without regard for how my actions might be viewed by those weaker in the faith, then I have the very attitude that Paul is here combating. If I insist on my rights, if I insist on my freedoms, if I insist on my way of doing things, I can cause spiritual harm to someone else. In short, if I still live like a worldly pagan person in terms of my selfishness and my self-centeredness, and a new believer looks at me, and a new believer observes from looking at me that there's really no difference in my life and the rest of the unbelieving world, then I am contributing to the destruction of their faith. And if I'm not considerate of that, if I don't care about that, then I am the person to whom Paul is writing. You see, it's not about what specific thing can I not do that equates to this. It's about a bigger attitude of selfishness and self-centeredness that says, I'm entitled to this. This is my right to do this. This is my freedom to do this. Anytime we say those things, anytime we say, well, it may not hurt to do, or it's not really wrong to, as preludes to a behavior that a newcomer or a weak brother or sister could see as harmful or even wrong. Anytime I do those things without considering the thoughts or the feelings of anyone else, then I'm acting selfishly and I am in the wrong. And here's the thing. If we are Spirit-filled, baptized believers, if we're Spirit-filled followers of Jesus Christ, we intuitively know what to do and what not to do. I believe that with all my heart. We intuitively know, because God's Spirit lives within us, we intuitively know what the right thing to do is and what the wrong thing to do is. And when this action is in this gray area that may not be wrong but could hurt, harm, destroy somebody else, I'm going to do it anyway because I'm entitled. It's my right. I'm free to do that. Most of us know when that's the wrong way to think. We have an enemy who I think has two great tools. The first tool is complacency and indifference to spiritual things. That's that tool that's causing some of you to turn me off about right now. And the other one is this tool where the enemy says, it's okay. You go ahead with that. You deserve that. That's not imitating Christ. And so I would remind us, what's the goal? What's the prize? You can make a decision for Christ. You can be baptized. You can attend worship services 3 out of 4 Sundays a month. You can drop in occasionally on Sunday night. Drop in occasionally on Wednesday nights or to a life group. You can work your job. You can make a good living. You can raise your kids while not thinking much of spiritual matters. You can pursue your hobbies and your outside interests. You can accumulate your retirement while not thinking much about God's will for your life. You can do these things. You can be a good person, at least appear to be a good person. You can not beat your wife, not beat your kids, not beat your dog or kick your cat, but never actually serve anybody else. You can not ever intentionally harm anyone. You can even help a few people on occasion. And you know, most of us would think that those things that I've said are attributes of a pretty good life. And you know what? It's your choice if that's the way you choose to live. But that is not imitating Jesus. That's not imitating Jesus. Imitating Jesus was about lovingly serving other people. And I would argue we were all meant for more than that. I love the Casting Crowns song, Thrive. We were made to thrive. We're made to thrive. And if we're going to thrive, self has to go. And that's really what this boils down to. Self has to go. Jonathan Edwards, famous 18th century revivalist preacher, said, resolved that all men should live for the glory of God. Resolved, second, that whether others do or not, I will. I will. And that's the challenge for us today. Will we live for the glory of God? We're going to sing a song as we continue our worship here in just a moment. I don't know what God is doing with this. I've struggled for many weeks as to how to present this, and I just trust that the words that came out of my mouth were the words that were supposed to come out of my mouth. What you do with it is up to you. I know the challenge for me. I know the challenge for me. And maybe it's the same with you. To live my life in view of what is good for other people instead of what's good for Mark. If we could all do that, we'd change this church. We'd change this city. May God help us to be the people He's called us and created us to be.